From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll tell you about a tool that empowers Milwaukee renters. We'll learn about the Ho-Chunk Nation's newly developed Department of Agriculture.
Everything here that we've planted has the ability to provide really healthy foods for our families. And if we compare that to foods that were provided to tribal people in the last hundreds of years, this is really different. This is really healthy.
Plus, we'll explore the scientific, cultural, and personal connections we have with the moon.
There was something so crisp and so immediate that I could touch the moon that I'd never forgot it. And I think if I can give that experience to others, that's a real gift.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. WUWM's Lena Tran and Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez had a mission this summer: experience the emergence of the periodical cicadas. Later in the show, they'll share how that adventure went, and quick spoiler, Jimmy is a little freaked out by bugs. But first, renting a home can be a daunting endeavor. There's the process of apartment hunting, finding the right space for your needs, and then the arduous background checks and financial assurances expected by nearly every prospective landlord. But the process of researching that landlord can be even more difficult. Understanding who you're renting from and how they conduct their business is crucial to a renter's safety and security. LandlordMapper.org has created a database of Milwaukee landlords and the properties they maintain. John Johnson is one of the creators of the tool, and he joins me now to talk about it. John, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Great to be here.
So how does the landlord mapper work? Walk us through the process of searching a property.
Yeah, so you can go to our website and put in the address of any rental property in the city of Milwaukee, just the city limits, and it'll tell you some information about that property, how much it's worth. It'll also tell you the other properties owned by that landlord and the other companies that are connected to that landlord. So large landlords, even some small landlords, often use a different LLC to own their different properties, sometimes one property per LLC. And so if you're just sort of naively looking at the data, it's very difficult to tell what a given landlord actually owns and the way that they behave across those properties. And so our tool does a network analysis of the names and addresses that are within these, what we call landlord networks, combines all of those together and gives you statistics for them. We calculate the eviction filing rate that those landlord networks have, the code violation rate, and the total value of the properties they held.
Sure. Now, how do you get this kind of information? Because as you say, each property might have its own LLC. A lot of this kind of data can be pretty opaque when you're just looking through it.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot of programming that happens on the back end. It updates every weekday. It pulls the latest property records from the city assessor's office. So that's our source of truth for who owns properties. That gets updated perhaps a month after a sale takes place. It varies based on the time of year, but they keep it pretty updated. And then we've built an open source code workflow that you can go and look at on GitHub if you're a nerd who's curious about this stuff. And then every 3 months or so, we go in and add new eviction data and code violation data.
Mm. What would you say you've learned so far about Milwaukee landlords?
Two things. One is that if you think of the typical landlord, if you just have all the landlords and you randomly choose one of them, probably that landlord is very small. They might only own one rental property. There are many, many landlords in the city who only own one property or maybe two properties besides the house they live in. But if you were to pick a renter at random, probably that renter rents from a quite large landlord. There's a handful of really large landlord networks that own 40% of the properties in the city. the largest of them, Barada, uses over 100 LLCs, as best I can tell. So depending on the perspective you have, if you're thinking about the landlords that exist, you'll think, well, this is a market that has a lot of small actors in it. But if you're thinking about the experience that tenants are having, actually, there's a handful of landlords in the city who control an awful lot of the supply that exists there. And we see that landlords behave in very different ways, one company to another. Some of them file evictions constantly. And we see a lot of serial eviction filing. So they'll do it, you know, on the fifth day of the month if they haven't paid rent yet, just sort of as a matter of course, whereas other landlords will, you know, only file evictions when they really mean it. And we see that most of their eviction filings actually lead to an eviction order instead of just being a sort of routine part of the rent collection process. The amount of code violations varies a lot between landlords. Some of them keep their houses in better repair than others. And we suspect, though we don't have the data on this yet, that the sort of level of rents and the aggressiveness with which a landlord raises rents varies a lot between companies. But that's really difficult to get data on. We don't collect good data on rents in this country. And so I'm hoping to do more research on that in the future. This sort of work gives us the ability to understand how much consolidation is happening in the rental market, which before was kind of a mystery. You know, we know that Barada is a large landlord because you see lots of properties in town that have those boulders around them or have a sign that says Barada Properties out in front. But it's not like there's one company that actually legally owns all those properties. And so it took a project like this to really figure out how large is that group of companies.
Yeah, when you say consolidation, what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, there's a landlord who has all of these different LLCs and that's kind of, you know, going under one umbrella? What does consolidation look like in this context?
Yeah, exactly that. So, you know, my research question is, what share of the rental apartments in the city are owned by, you know, let's say the largest five landlords or something like that. So we're working on a project now to try to understand, you know, is there pricing power in that market? Is there a level of consolidation that would kind of cause the competition that we expect to keep prices down in a market not to be happening? TBD, you know, we're still working on that project, but it's the kind of thing that we're able to do now that we're able to link landlords in this way. And then also the service we've made is designed to be a tool for tenants. You know, maybe you would prefer to have a large landlord because you think they'll offer prompter service, or maybe you'd prefer to have a small neighborhood landlord. This is a tool you can use to understand the size and complexity of the corporation you're renting from.
I think that really gets to the larger question of, you know, what are the ways that tenants or prospective tenants can use this tool and the information it provides? What can they do with that?
Yeah, I recommend anyone who's looking for apartments to use this tool to just understand more about who they might be renting from, because when you call the number you see on the listing, that, you know, that might just be a property management company. Or you might not really understand the relationship that person you're talking to on the phone has to the ownership of the house you're looking at. And this way you can see, you know, is this just a small landlord who only owns this property or only owns a couple properties? Or is this part of a corporate web of, you know, dozens of LLCs that all share a P.O. box in California? You know, you'll see examples of that sometimes. And while that in itself can't tell you, is this a good landlord or a bad landlord, you know, based on your past experiences, you might have preferences for a certain kind of landlord. And then also we do show eviction filing rates and code violation rates for those landlord networks. We redact the eviction information for individual properties that only have a few units. But when there's, you know, a larger number of units in a network, we'll tell you what that rate is, which might be useful information for some renters.
What do you hope to achieve as you're getting more information for this database? What are some of your goals for this tool personally?
Yeah, well, one goal is what we were just talking about, to let renters understand more about their landlords. As it is, when you apply to rent a unit, the landlord gets all kinds of information about you. You know, that background check is pretty extensive, but the renter might not even know who the landlord is. You know, they might not even know the name of the LLC they're renting from. They just know where they send the check. And so this is, I wouldn't say it evens the playing field, but it at least gives a little bit more information to a renter about what they're getting into. Then we have this set of research questions we want to answer to understand more about the market dynamics that are shaping the rental market in Milwaukee. And that has potentially some important policy consequences. I often have discussions with people who assume that a large corporate landlord would actually be better than small landlords, because in sort of an Econ 101 model, the thinking goes that a large landlord would be able to charge cheaper rents because they're spreading the risk over more properties. And so it's the risk is more manageable and they should be able to pass those savings on to renters, and that a large company would be more professional in the way that it responded to complaints and maintained properties than maybe a small part-time landlord would be. And, you know, there's a way in which, as a theory, that might make sense, but pretty much all the evidence that I've seen is the opposite, that actually small landlords tend to provide a higher quality tenant experience, to raise rents less aggressively, to file evictions at a lower rate, to only file evictions when they like actually intend to reclaim the property in breach of contract rather than as just part of the rent collection process, and various other things that other researchers have found, that a sort of neighborhood landlord tends to offer a higher quality experience. But it's only through rigorously answering those questions in an empirical way that I think we can say, okay, these are the kinds of landlords we want to encourage more of, and these are the kinds that we want to avoid in our city. And that matters for the kinds of building code updates or zoning code updates that the city might pursue. For example, there's a discussion in the city right now about making it easier to build accessory dwelling units, so like replacing your garage with a small housing unit. And most of those would be rentals. So it would be good to know, are sort of small-time landlords a good experience for tenants overall, in which case having a lot of these ADUs would be a good thing. In contrast, maybe we think that tenants could have the best experience renting from a large landlord in an apartment building, in which case, you know, there's things the city could do to promote that. So answering those kinds of questions about what creates the best tenant experience is a goal for this project.
All right. Well, we'll see what the future holds. It's a very interesting tool as it is. John, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette Law School's Lubar Center and one of the creators of LandlordMapper.org. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about the upcoming Observe the Moon Night event at the UWM Planetarium. But first, we'll visit a plot of land in western Wisconsin, where the Ho-Chunk Nation is producing healthy food for families and creating opportunities for others to do the same. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. WUWM and the NPR Network are dedicating this week to stories about climate solutions. The focus is on food. Climate change is affecting our food, and food is affecting our climate. This week, we search for solutions. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz traveled to Whirling Thunder Ranch just outside Tomah. It's one of the places the Ho-Chunk Nation is working to create food sovereignty through learning and teaching. Hinu Smith is executive director of the nation's Department of Agriculture. It's just 1 year old with a staff of six. She explains how their work offers food solutions for the tribe.
We've been doing a lot, and even though we only have 1/3 of an acre of vegetables at two sites, it's been an awful lot, and we've had a lot of volunteerism coming from the UW, as well as other farms and community members as well. So you'll see that most of it is cover crop. We're doing trials, demonstration trials, to show the community, and as well as to collect data for ourselves, what the different impacts that cover crops have. We have a pollinator planting in there, so that's bringing in a lot of activity. But then we also have different types of cover crop too that we wanted to demonstrate as ways that you can suppress weeds, ways that you can break up the ground, ways that you can amend the ground as well. So there's a lot of different things happening, and we've had a lot of input and feedback from the university and RPI. So that's been a really important part of what we've been doing for the last year.
So is this a little chunk of like close to 400 acres that the...
Almost 480 acres are located here.
And the rest of it is, how is it being, or is it waiting for...
It's waiting for us. So a lot of it is wooded. If you look off here, that slope there, there's a lot of activity happening from the DNR, our tribal DNR office, and they're planting various different types of trees down there. So hopefully in a few years we can do some harvesting of fruit and nut trees down there.
Where does the learning also, are people taking this back to their families?
Yeah, you know, it was really rewarding to see that last fall when we had the corn harvest events, we did some hand harvesting of a Native American variety of corn. We did corn braiding, we did hominy making, we did outdoor cooking, you know, a few different events that day. And then just a couple of weeks ago, a couple of volunteers came and they brought some of the corn that they had harvested that day. They went home because they had learned how to make hominy, traditional hominy out of ash. They went home, made that, dried it, and they came back and gifted some of that to our staff. And it's like, oh, if that just doesn't make you feel good, I don't know what does. But otherwise, people are learning or teaching, right? Because a lot of our community members are avid gardeners. We have a couple of farmers. I can't tell you how many because we're lacking data, because we're a reservationless tribe. So
explain that.
We are the only tribe in the state of Wisconsin that does not have a reservation. We do have land held in trust for us by the federal government, and it's scattered throughout the state and a little bit into Minnesota. So we're what is called a checkerboarded tribe. That's a BIA term. And so we have land
Bureau
all
of
over.
Indian Affairs, right?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Bureau of Indian Affairs. That logistically makes things pretty tough because now we have to serve and provide different types of services across all of this region.
I was thinking back to your comment about food as medicine and how, and thinking of health and the holistic connection between what's being grown here and what also you're sharing as far as some of the learning, and how that goes back into the focus on health and wellness.
When I think of food as medicine, I think about something an elder had taught me years ago, that every step we take on Mother Earth, we're blessed with life. And so every time we're out here and we're walking these grounds and we're touching the earth, it's cathartic, it's healing, it's a blessing, and it's giving us life. And everything here that we've planted in terms of food has the ability to provide really healthy foods for our families. And if we compare that to foods that were provided to tribal people in the last hundreds of years, this is really different. This is really healthy. And when we think about that in those times when the government was providing food, it may not have been healthy, or it may not have been unspoiled, or it may not have even been available. And then if we move forward in time, we have the food distribution program, and there was a time when that was highly processed and really unhealthy. So a lot of flour, butter, lard, canned meats that were really high in fat. And so now we have different initiatives happening across the country where our people, or other people, but tribal people is really what we want to focus on, can actually produce food at some place like this and then sell that back into the food distribution program so that our people can have fresh fruits and vegetables. And so just taking charge of those food systems in every different way that we can is really important. And so what we want to do here is identify food producers that we have in our communities, or help create people to become those producers that can start filling these gaps, not only in our food distribution program, but maybe replace these major trucks that are providing processed foods to our casinos or our Head Starts or our elderly feeding sites. You know, if we can start to, you know, create enough food, get infrastructure to process that, and then get that into our tribal entities or even local school systems, you know, that's one of the goals that we have here. And that means teaching and training and supporting our producers.
Is the vision that with time, more and more of this land will be farmed and really be producing some of that food that you've just described?
What we have is a lot of agricultural land across the state of Wisconsin, and we have tribal members across the state of Wisconsin. We have land in Wisconsin Dells area, Toma area, Black River Falls area, Nakusa area, Wittenberg area, you know, all over. And the topography is different. The soil is going to be different. And so if we can support our tribal people to be producers or become producers, that's what we want to do. But what does that mean? You know, it could be conventional farming or organic and regenerative farming with vegetable and produce or animal production, or it could be food foraging, tree tapping, fishing, or trapping. It can mean a lot of different things. And so we want to be able to support that. You know, one of the ways, an easy way to reduce one of the barriers is to make our land accessible to the people. So that is something that we are working on in the Department of Agriculture, and access to equipment. You know, we don't expect people to go out and buy a $100,000 piece of equipment to go see if they like farming. But this is where we can help, and we can have that equipment. We can train people on how to use equipment, bring our equipment on site if they want to be a producer, and assist with some of that. And so there's a lot of different ways that we can assist, but we want to address barriers to access.
Where do you hope this all leads for your people?
A food sovereignty and sustainability. That really means taking control over all of our food systems and turning that inward and being self-reliant. That doesn't necessarily mean the Department of Agriculture produces all this food for free for all of our people. What it really means is supporting our people to be able to do that for themselves, or if they choose not to, that they can source that food from their people or their tribe. And so it's a lot of work. There's a lot to be done. I say agriculture can be the catalyst to everything. Economic development, education, a lot of different things. And so we have a lot of gaps in our food system, and we saw that it became resoundingly clear, if it wasn't already, during the pandemic. Now that was something our tribal people already knew, and mainstream knew, but we were able to put it off on the back burner until we came into this pandemic and we saw major infrastructure shut down, major loss of food. We saw also a lot of resilience happening too, with food being redirected. So maybe foods weren't going into school systems, but they were going out into the community in food boxes. Out of that, the Tribal Elder Food Box idea came to be. And so a lot of those food boxes, we saw a person getting 4, 5, 8 gallons of milk, a gallon of yogurt, things that are really difficult for many of our tribal people to consume because of different allergies or issues, just digesting these types of foods that are basically a foreign food. And so out of that came the Tribal Elder Food Box Initiative and creating boxes of food that are more culturally appropriate, healthy, and consumable to tribal people. That has been happening for 3 years in all the tribal communities of Wisconsin within all the tribes. And so that's a really big effort toward tribal sovereignty. And then that also has this collateral impact, right? So wanting to be able to source food for these boxes from tribal people. It's really difficult to do that if you don't have all of the infrastructure, hard infrastructure, soft infrastructure. And so the collaborations that are happening, you know, with the different resources to make that happen in terms of aggregation and distribution and just recruiting people. So when we talk about food sovereignty, back to your question, I will just summarize it as food sovereignty. It takes a lot of work and a lot of effort. And so what we want to do is to be able to kind of eventually be able to fill all of these gaps within our food system. We want to be able to provide all of these foods if we can, whether it's produce. Here we're focusing on produce. But in coming years, there's the option of poultry or beef or bison. There's the option of creating value-added product, but we also have to focus on that lack of infrastructure, not just for the nation, but for our people. So when I think of the Department of Agriculture needing infrastructure to be able to expand what we're doing, we also need that infrastructure to support our tribal people to become producers or expand their production. And then we need to multiply that by multiple sites, right, across our geography here. So that whole movement of becoming self-sustainable, well, I guess it's sort of daunting. Back to your term before. It's doable. Yeah. We can do it. And we have a lot of resources. We have a lot of connection, a lot of relationships with the University of Wisconsin, with the Extension, with RPI. And so there's a lot of things happening behind the scenes. And so pretty soon you'll see an explosion of activity happening, not only in Ho-Chunk agriculture, but in indigenous agriculture across the state.
Hinu Smith is the executive director of the Ho-Chunk Nation's Department of Agriculture. You also heard from Tricia Gorby, the director of UW-Madison Extension's Natural Resource Institute. They spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. This Saturday is International Observe the Moon Night. UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium will be marking the occasion both indoors and out to help people learn about the moon and appreciate the personal and cultural connections we have with it. Astronomy contributor Jean Creighton joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more.
So the Manfred Olson Planetarium is going to be celebrating International Observe the Moon Night. And of course, there's so much to explore about our closest celestial neighbor. But for you, what's one of your favorite facts or aspects about the moon that sticks out?
There's lots to choose from, as you can imagine. But what jumps to my mind is how bright the moon is. I have grown up in large cities. I've lived in large cities. So the effect gets lost a little bit. I had an opportunity, though, recently to go to the Grand Portage Reservation in Minnesota to work with a colleague there. And I was so looking forward to visiting this area because it's a dark spot, and I felt certain that I'd be able to see the Milky Way. I hadn't done my homework, and I hadn't figured out what the phase of the moon was, and my heart sank when I realized the moon is full. And it is so bright that it was casting sharp shadows on the ground. Needless to say, there was no Milky Way to be had. So even though I had the opportunity to see some beautiful photography of a local photographer, Travis Nowitzki, sadly, I was not able to see the Milky Way for myself. So to remind ourselves that one of the reasons why everybody on the planet feels some connection to the moon is that for many thousands of years, that was a source of light at nighttime.
I've had maybe just a handful of those experiences, like what maybe I'm camping or something, where it's like, I don't need a flashlight to walk back at night. And it's such a surreal experience because you're like, wow, that is bright. And we don't get that very often here in Milwaukee.
That's right. And in fact, when I took a picture of the moon rising over Lake Superior and I sent that to my spouse, he said, oh, that's the sun. I said, no. I mean, the camera is obviously playing some tricks too, but that's how bright it looked.
Yeah. And outside of brightness, the moon is something that also changes to us near constantly, right? So that's something to note, too, that this is one of the few things we can observe and see how it changes.
That's right, with a naked eye. And it changes in many ways, right? It changes in terms of how much of the illuminated sky we see, in other words, what phase it's in. But also where it rises, where it sets. Is it going to clear that building across the street or not? So if you are attentive, if you actually spend the time to observe the moon for a month, a couple times a year, you'll see oh, it's completely different now. And I think there's something heartwarming of that reminder of things change.
Mm-hmm. Things are changing, but it's still a constant presence.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And part of the celebration for the planetarium is covering lunar exploration. It's always been a big part of American history and culture, the moon landing, of course. But can you share a little bit about some of the history you'll be exploring or some of the current or upcoming lunar explorations that are happening?
Mm-hmm. It can be fun to talk about history, but we're going to focus mostly on future exploration, what are our plans are. We've already sent Artemis 1, which was a rocket that went to the moon, what we call unmanned, right? So there's nobody on board. And there they do some checks that the orbitals are going to work. You know, the rocket has what it takes to do to go back and forth. In a year, Artemis 2, so the second in the series, is going to take a crew and do kind of what Apollo 8 did. So they're going to do all the maneuvers that Artemis 3 is going to do without landing. And there's something that probably is true. It sounds apocryphal, though, that the Apollo mission, the equivalent Apollo 8, they didn't give them enough fuel to be sure that they don't attempt a landing.
Mm.
Because they're pilots, right? Yes. They might decide, I can do this. And a year later, then we're going to do the final stepping on the moon. For the first time, a woman and a person of color, 50-some years after the last time a person stood on the moon.
That's amazing.
It is.
Yeah.
So it's very exciting.
And outside of a strictly scientific look at the moon and what we're exploring on it, there, of course, is so much that is culturally connected with it. So what are some of these connections that you'll be exploring?
The principal, I think, a connection is calendars, that people around the world in a variety of contexts use the lunar calendar to determine their holidays, their feasts, their celebrations, and, you know, they plan life around it. Well, that's pretty profound that the moon is actually your timekeeper.
Definitely. And it's something that's so ingrained in our calendars, too, that you just take a moment to think about. It's like, of course, you mm-hmm. know, makes total sense. And with exploring science, culture, just simply observing, there's both an indoor aspect inside the planetarium and, weather permitting, an outdoor portion for mm-hmm. this event, right?
Yes. So, of course, we want people to see the moon with their eyes, but it would be nice to put either a modest telescope or even a pair of binoculars in front of people so that multiple people can see it together. I have to confess that for me, my very first time I looked through a telescope to see the moon, my socks were just blown off. I was so impressed. And it might not sound intuitive because, you know, I went on to study galaxies and star formation and all kinds of cool things. But there was something so crisp and so immediate that I could touch the moon that I'd never forgot it. And I think if I can give that experience to others, that's a real gift.
Absolutely. And there's something that touches you differently when you can see distinct physical features mm-hmm. that makes it like a little more tangible
yeah.
versus a lot of space science, right?
Yeah, so it's a place that you can imagine going, right? It
yeah.
might not be a great place to go visit and not easy, but it becomes a world. It becomes a place that you can connect to. And I think that has great value. So let's hope for nice weather.
Yes, fingers crossed. Well, thank you for coming in today, Jean, to share some more connections about the moon ahead of the event. I appreciate it.
It's so much fun always. Thank you, Audrey.
Jean Creighton is our astronomy contributor and the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UWM. The planetarium will be hosting Observe the Moon Night on September 14th. Weather permitting, they'll have a free outdoor telescope viewing. You can find more information at wuwm.com. This summer, millions of cicadas emerge from the ground, capturing the attention of people all over the country.
I really love them because they're cute and they're derpy and they've gone through a lot of hardship to get to where they are, but ultimately when they come out, they're beautiful and they come out strong and they come out in groups, and I think that's really neat of them.
We'll bring you the story of two WUWMers on a mission to experience the cicada emergence. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This summer was the summer of cicadas. After spending the last 17 years underground, millions of periodical cicadas emerged in southern Wisconsin. WUWM's Lena Tran and Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez went to Lake Geneva to experience the emergence for themselves.
So, Jimmy, we're past Labor Day weekend. Summer is coming to an end. How are we feeling?
All right. First, I live for a long weekend.
For sure.
Okay. But not to be too somber about summer, but it felt like a goodbye. And things I love are that kids are back to school. I'm not constantly sweating from all that corn, but I am already feeling nostalgic thinking back on summer.
And of course, thinking back on my summer, it was all about cicadas.
Oh my God. I feel like this was your best summer ever.
Best summer ever.
It was like equal parts the summer of cicadas and the summer of Lena, but because of the cicadas.
I was obsessed right away. I mean, they're underground for 17 years, feeding on sap from tree roots. They emerge and they just have a couple months to, you know, eat, be eaten, mate, lay some eggs. It's real circle of life stuff. And it kind of made me think about how at the beginning of every summer, I feel this need to have a really great one, to make something of these beautiful long days we have in Milwaukee, to not miss a single farmer's market.
Okay, can I say the farmer's market bouquets were out of control this year? But yeah, yes, agreed. Also, though, besides farmer's markets and cicadas, this was a big summer for you.
Yeah, I'm going through this transition. You know, I just moved to Chicago. So this summer, I had to say goodbye to Milwaukee. I found these periodical cicadas to be weirdly relatable. And when I learned that Lake Geneva, right in the middle of Milwaukee and Chicago, is the place to experience Wisconsin's own brood, well, you know I had to drive down there.
That's the worst kind of ASMR for me.
It was insane. I could hear them through my car.
I don't like any of this.
Even with the windows up, the moment I crossed into town, it was like Lake Geneva. This place had been chosen.
All right, you just created a brand new nightmare for me.
Yeah, well, I talked to PJ Leash. He's an entomologist at UW-Madison. He says what we're hearing here is this duet between male and female cicadas.
A duet?
The males have these membranes on the side of their body called timbals. It's like the membrane on a drum. For this month or so while they were out, it's the males singing or screaming to attract the attention of females. At a close range, the females can snap her wings. And so you get this little back and forth calling between males and females. Eventually they mate. The females will then lay eggs. And a few weeks later, they're done and gone for 17 more years.
This wasn't going to happen for another 17 years? I was like, I need the people in my life to experience this.
I'm in your life. And you know, I'm always down for an adventure. So you, me, and our partners all carpool down. And I'm thinking maybe that in real life, the sound of them would be like soothing or maybe impressive. You know, after all, this is a summer of emergence.
It is. So next, we go to Lake Geneva.
Okay, maybe a bit of foreshadowing, but driving down, the sky was really gray. And it started to sprinkle. And the closer we got, the harder it rained.
It turns out cicadas aren't really fans of rain. You know, they'll crawl under leaves and take shelter. And that means no more mating calls.
I do think that we still made the best of it, thanks in large part to Cicada Palooza.
Cicada Palooza!
Yeah, Cicada Palooza, which is a real thing and was happening at the library. Downtown Lake Geneva was packed, all these puddled streets and cicada lovers and tour groups dotting each block. It was like Lena's as far as the eye could see.
These were my people. So many parents braved the weather to bring their kids. I met Annalise, she's 11, and her mom, Samantha, they came down from Argyle. Annalise could not drag her eyes away from this little jar that had two cicadas she'd caught. And Samantha told me that the two of them are bug nerds.
That means when you see something, you're like, oh, come look at this!
Like when I saw the cicada emerging earlier.
Yeah.
I'm like, come, everyone.
Oh, look. It's like you just won the jackpot. Annalise, these cicadas are older than you. Like, and they're just about ready to vote. I mean, they're getting to be to the point where, yeah, like anybody that's like here, yeah, it's a good chunk of your life is like, they've been down there underneath our feet, not even knowing that they were there.
All right, this image is not helping. I did find someone who did help, though, and there were these really cute entomology students from UW, and they had a good reframe for me other than zombie bugs. Ari Maurer even got philosophical talking about the cicada journey.
So cicadas are a creature of patience, right? They spend all of this time underground, and they're just waiting for this perfect opportune time. What's crazy about them is we don't exactly know why they know it's that opportune time, and we don't know why they come up every 13 or 17 years, they just do it. And I think that's something a lot of people relate to. They spend their entire lives waiting for that kind of perfect time. But unlike cicadas, we have to realize that we don't just have a vibe like that or a feeling. We got to take that own initiative, and I think that they make the gigantic jump from underground to on trees, and we can do the exact same thing. I really love them because they're cute and they're derpy and they've gone through a lot of hardship to get to where they are, but ultimately when they come out, they're beautiful and they come out strong and they come out in groups, and I think that's really neat of them.
All right, at this point, like, I'm all in. I'm full on Team Cicada. And then under this tent of cicada plushes, yes, cicada plushes, I look to my right and there's a small child and he's got cicadas crawling all over him.
Oh my God.
What is that on your hand?
A cicada.
Cicada? Are you not scared that it's like crawling all over you?
No.
What does it look like?
It looks like a big, huge, fuzzy, like a baby frog.
Like a baby frog?
But more than their legs. And it has wings. And red eyes.
It looks like it's very curious of you too.
Yeah, it likes me.
All right, this is Soren Binney, and we talked for a bit. He calmed me down, and then he had a few questions for me.
Do you like cicadas?
Do I like cicadas? I am learning to like cicadas, and you made me braver to feel like I could hold a cicada. So if you can believe it, I'm actually going to go and try to eat a cicada.
Oh, my gosh.
All right, I just want to be clear here that this did not come out of nowhere. This was always kind of a part of our unspoken mission, especially after so many people at Cicada Palooza talked about eating them and that cicadas were on every menu in town.
Jimmy, somehow you went from being kind of squeamish around just the idea of cicadas to being very committed to eating one. And I mean, you know, I was down to eat one.
I mean, if I saw Soren handling them, it felt like a call to action, a call that I had to answer.
I really wanted this to happen for you. And because of the rain, we saw the cicadas we could. I was hoping there would be enough to swim in, but, you know, maybe I can settle for enough to eat and drink.
And so it began. I looked up every place that served food and drink. I'm talking breweries, fancy seafood spots, ice cream parlors. Anyone and everyone that was open, I called and asked, hey, by chance, do you have cicadas on the menu? And I will say, I have not felt as rejected since I was a teenager. And then an angel answered the phone and said, yes, we can put cicadas on anything. Maggie Moo's Dairy Ripple was my savior, and salvation was a mere 15 minutes away.
We should say that you didn't just call these places. We went to a number of them, a supper club, this bar. We even followed a lead from someone who said they were selling seasoned cicadas by the pound in the parking lot at a state park.
It sounded so promising.
Yeah, but the ranger gently informed us this was not the case when we pulled up to the gate.
Not that sells them to eat, not here.
This is why Maggie Moo's hurt so bad.
We've been had.
All right. Well, you guys are cute. This place is cute as hell. So maybe we'll just get something to eat. It's non-cicada related.
If I give you a bowl of dipped chocolate, you can pour it on whatever you want to. I'm not saying you have to pour it on cicadas, but you can. But I'm not gonna allow any cicadas into my building.
Okay, fair. Understood.
All right, so it's a little bit of a gray area.
Okay.
I don't like bugs.
The same.
But if you have some cicadas of your own, that's your choice.
Okay.
I will give you whatever you need to dress them with.
So, quick update is that called up Maggie Moose. They told me we can put cicadas on anything. Very promising. And we get here and they have cicadas on nothing. They said they will not let them into the shop. And it turns out they thought that I was calling and pranking them. And in turn, they pranked us.
I felt very bad that our cicada adventure was such a bust. By this point, we'd pretty much gone full circle around Lake Geneva, so we were back in town.
But you did have a genius idea.
The cemetery?
Yes, the cemetery, because we had all the dip set to go. We just needed some cicada protein.
Yeah, I didn't know if you were serious, but if you were, I knew the cemetery was the stop. It's the oldest one in town, so it was one of the best places to see tons of cicadas. They haven't been disturbed for almost 200 years.
You were right. There were tons of them.
Oh, hell no. No. It's making noises.
Can you hear them?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like hissing almost.
There's a live one on the tree.
I don't know if I can eat him.
I don't know if I can eat him either.
They're so sweet. I'd like all
Jimmy, how are we feeling here?
Like a coward? I was ready to be a coward. Besides all the cicadas, the cemetery was pretty empty. There was, though, a couple across the street that we noticed. The trunk of their car was open, and they were kind of huddling over it and looked like they were working on something.
Are you all performing cicada science over here?
We are.
Wait, what's happening over here? Do you mind? We're with Milwaukee Public Radio, so.
Oh, right on.
We are collecting whatever we can from Chicago and from here and from Wisconsin to see what we actually collect, if we can tell the difference between the different species. Okay. And so we're preserving them in some dry ice, labeling where we got them from. And I'm going to take them back and look at them under a microscope, see if we can differentiate the species, see if we can tell which broods are which, if they're the 17 or the 13 year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, that's Erica Morales. She's an entomologist at New Mexico State University. And she had recruited her partner, Chad, possibly against his will, to be her assistant.
When we first arrived here, we went to go get some pizza in Chicago. And we are walking around in the parking lot, and they are everywhere. It was perfect. I was kind of in heaven, and the first thing that one does to my finger, as I picked one up, they say they don't bite, they say they don't sting, which they technically don't bite or sting, but they may tell you they pierce. And one little guy landed on my finger, and he's like trying to put her little proboscis or her mouth part. She's trying to put her mouth part into my finger, and you can see her trying to get some phloem from there, but she's not going to get
much. She thought you were a tree.
She thought I was a tree. Best compliment ever. Best compliment ever, yeah.
I have a question about food. Have either of you eaten them yet or have any interest to eat them?
Just did at the library.
Yeah. I spoon-fed him. I spoon-fed him a cicada. He had no idea what was going in his mouth. They were handing out these little ice cream sundaes. I was actually going to eat it, and I don't know if you said something or if you looked at me. I'm like, oh, he wants one. So I just picked it up and I spoon-fed it to him. I was like, oh, by the way, I think this is the
cicada.
Yeah,
we still have a little bit of growth in our relationship. He wants one. No,
that's
not what I was saying. That's not what I was communicating. But it wasn't. So the next question, it was a little crunchy. Yeah. It was just like any other little crunchy topping you might have in your ice cream.
Okay.
No other particular flavor.
Not freaked out, no hesitation.
Of course I was freaked out. I was like, what the hell? But no gross taste, no, just an emotional reaction. Like, oh, that's a
where we're at,
chunky, that's where our relationship is at.
We might not have heard the collective scream of cicadas that day. We might not have eaten them, but we did find this really sweet cicada science couple. So I just want to check in with you. Where are you now on your cicada journey?
Yeah, still have not eaten, but I still have my butterscotch dip. But I felt like the cicada and I grew closer, you know? Like, it felt like at the end of this, it was a summer of emergence. The cicada people emerged, you included. I did as well, handling bugs. And I did lean into the wonder of how wild an occurrence this really is. And, you know, at the end of the day, what is summer if it's not love, big transitions, and a little buggy?
Yeah, I love that. The cool thing about these periodical cicadas is they kind of let us time travel. Like, I can picture it 17 years from now, getting excited for another emergence. But also, I'll be thinking back to this summer and how I fell under the cicada's spell and how we had this ridiculous adventure in Lake Geneva. I'm really grateful for the cicadas. They made my last summer in Wisconsin, for now, one to remember.
All right, so Lake Geneva reunion, 17 years.
See you there.
That was WUWM's Lena Tran and Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll tell you about Milwaukee's King Community Center and what it gives the community. And we'll get a preview of WUWM Vaughn Fellow Nadia Kelly's upcoming project that examines Milwaukee's public art. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.